We were sitting in an adult Bible class a long time ago in a more conservative church than this one, and someone brought up the subject of wine. As you know, some church people think the only use of wine is no use at all, and they try to find support for that in the Bible. So on that day, a lovable elder who wanted to give us all a warning read a couple of verses from the Proverbs. It is not good for kings to be drinking wine, nor for princes to love strong drink, for fear that in their cups they will forget their laws and misjudge somebody's case. He had not noticed the assumption in those words that others would drink wine, that only on special occasions and for special reasons should one be careful. But there was a worse omission. I asked him, kindly, I believe, what the next two verses meant. And he read them. Give wine to a man who is about to perish, someone whose heart is full of bitterness. Let him drink and forget his misfortune and remember his misery no more. He had never considered that there might be a proper use for wine, even a commanded use for wine. And he could not give us a coherent interpretation. The truth is, of course, that the Bible teaches moderation, but it does not teach abstinence. The blessing of Isaac upon Jacob is a typical Jewish notion of good luck. May God give you plenty of grain and wine. And when David says, my cup runneth over, you can be sure he was not referring to goat's milk. In churches that want the Bible to teach total abstinence, it is argued that when the Bible mentions wine, it means grape juice. The argument is as weak as water. There are three ways to keep grape juice fresh and drinkable in a hot climate: by refrigeration, by vacuum sealed bottles, or by fermentation. The Jewish people fermented it, so that when wine is mentioned, it is often with the implied or explicit realization that it could make people drunk. The Corinthian church members, drinking wine at their love feast, were getting tipsy before the time came for communion. So obviously that Paul rebuked them. But he never suggested abstinence, only moderation. He had grown up in a Jewish tradition that spoke of wine in words like these: wine is like life to men if you drink it in moderation. What life has a man who is without wine? For it was created to give gladness to men, an exhilaration to the heart and gladness to the soul. Not having been brought up in Paul's tradition, wine has never meant that much to me. But even if I despised it, integrity would prohibit my insisting to others that the Bible makes it sinful. There may be times when this particular gift, a gift from God if you believe the Bible, has to be given up by some people. I met an old friend in Dallas last week who had discovered that he had a problem with alcohol in any form, so he touches nothing now. I respect and applaud his decision. I also respect the fact that he would never dream of telling people who have no problem that they too must join him in total abstinence. I speak of these things first because I want to talk about that delightful little story in the Gospel of John, which has Jesus at a wedding party in Cana, a village within easy walking distance of his own. What I find exciting first is the fact that he was there. Because a Jewish wedding feast was not a teacup and finger sandwich affair. It lasted 7 days, and wine flowed freely. People laughed, danced, told jokes, and kept a warm, friendly eye on Uncle Simon and Aunt Rachel, who sometimes drank a bit more than was good for them. I like the idea that when they invited Jesus to come, no one thought that somehow he would be out of his element. No one whispered when they saw him coming, "Uh-oh, here comes that preacher. Watch your language now, and somebody go see if we have some lemonade." No awkward silence when he entered the room. No steering him away from little knots of farmers telling their racy little jokes about honeymoons. No making sure that the holy man would not be contaminated by the touch and breath of ordinary human beings. If he had had the reputation of a killjoy and a prude, I don't think anyone would have invited him to come and spoil the party. I'm almost embarrassed to feel I should say this, but I shall do it anyway. Surely, no one will think that I am making a case for drunkenness or for crude and disgusting behavior. There would have been such moments in the social life of Jesus of Nazareth, and he would have responded to them probably much as we do, but it would be a response of wise caring and patience and perhaps suggested discipline, but not withdrawal from the world. The famous prayer in John's Gospel has Christ saying about his disciples, not that he wants to take them out of the world, but that they make it better by their presence in it, by their restraint, by their joy. My idea of the kingdom of heaven is not that we have designated Christian restaurants and Christian laundromats where you can be guaranteed freedom from the talk and touch of non-believers, but a world in which Christians are like leaven in a loaf, a church college that is branded, inspected, approved, USDA Christian, instead of being mixed up in the ragu of society, does not seem very useful to me. Well, so Jesus was there. That's the first big thing. And apparently at the time, no one even recognized him as, quote, the religious man. It's odd, isn't it, that apparently no one in his home thought of Jesus as especially religious, certainly not sanctimonious, that none of his friends, as a boy or a man in Nazareth, joined in his movement, or so far as we know, took it seriously. There's no way to know this. But I rather fancy that Jesus was the quiet one in the family, that for years he moved around in a kind of understated way, fixing a broken toy for a child in his father's carpenter shop, looking here and there for some way to be helpful. And I'm interested very much in that word this morning, helpful. A simple, much neglected word, so important to this story. When the host at the wedding party was running out of wine, perhaps because Jesus and his disciples came with their own thirst and he had not planned on them, we're told that Jesus exercised his power to see to it that they would not run out, contributed 120 gallons of first-rate Chablis or Burgundy or whatever it was, and it was not grape juice. The reason I know is that when people tasted it, they said, well, this is really something. Most people put out the good wine first at a party and save the poor wine until the last. Obviously, when taste was not so discriminating, after you'd had a great many cups already, but you've given us the best wine near the end of the party. Do what you like with the story. People have read it very differently. If you can only read it as historical in every detail, so be it. If you read it as an allegory of how Jesus blesses life with abundance, as I do, so be it. But in either case, think about the glory of that simple, prosaic helpfulness. It's a humble word, buried under a lot of big ones, but life would be poor without it. How do I love thee? Mrs. Browning asks in her famous sonnet. Let me count the ways. How about just doing the dishes tonight? With what celestial perfection do I worship thee, my love? How about bathing the kids? Oh, what wisdom I got today from my Bible study class. How about picking up your socks? The little things that help do not seem important enough, I suppose, so people forget them. I know a father right now who works hard and makes a lot of money and has given it freely to his children. And now there's a daughter messed up with drugs and headed for counseling, talking of suicide. And you know what she keeps coming back to when they sit now and confront the years together? Daddy, you never told me I did anything right. You never said, honey, that was just great. You never said, I love you. I just wanted to hear you say, I love you. The seeds of security do not come from stocks and bonds. They are sown when mothers and fathers rock their kids to sleep, tie their shoes, wipe their noses, sing songs and read books and say without being asked, I love you. But some of the straightest people you have ever met cannot do that. If I had to sum up 10 things from a lifetime of ministry, I think I know what one would be that I consider tremendously important. It's the truth in that perceptive remark by George Eliot, brilliant English woman novelist who took a man's name. That remark from which I cribbed the odd title of this sermon. There are those whose celestial intimacies seem not to improve their domestic manners. She had been in preachers' houses, I think. And I'm glad Billy cannot speak. Forgive me for paraphrasing, but maybe that goes by too fast when you only speak it. She had seen pious people who were not helpful or kind. Churchgoers with their mouths constantly full of scripture and the phrases of prayer who watched with narrow eyes for a neighbor to slip, whose tongues wagged wickedly when it happened, who were never helpful to anybody except themselves. Do you know anyone like that? A person for whom the sugared phrases of religion come easily to the lips, but who seem not the least affected by any of them? Who sing and pray and nod agreement to the sermon and go home to sulk across the table? Ignore the little things that might make life easier on their spouses? Yell at their children for running out all the hot water? People who vote law and order tickets and then gleefully cheat on their income tax? Who lambast the public criminal but cut every little corner they can? Who talk glowingly of friendship but only call you when they need something? Who make a tax-deductible gift to the Humane Society and then go home and kick the family dog? Celestial intimacy on a first-name basis with God and domestic manners, how you behave at home, they do not necessarily correspond. I sometimes think that if we were to make a list of the things we had done that we thought had impressed perhaps our friends or our children, it might not correspond very well at all with their own lists. Little things, moments of consideration and of patience, stick so deeply in the heart that nothing ever pushes them out. It is so strange to me, in view of all the big things he did for me, that I should still think most tenderly of my father as I saw him on the living room floor at night after work playing marbles with me, much too tired to want to do it, and not interested in getting better on the school playground as I was, but just willing to be helpful to me at the end of a long day because he loved me. He was severe with discipline. I deserved and got some memorable whacks with willow switches. But I do not feel them. I do not see him in my memory with punishment in his hand. I see him stretched out on the floor playing a game. The discipline he gave me was necessary for a boy who was creatively naughty. The love, I have no doubt at all, saved my life. When I was in Dallas, my host, Paul McGee, whom some of you met last summer when he was here, a former student of mine, now a professor of sociology and for a long, long time a preaching minister in a number of churches. Celestial intimacy he had. When I walked out on Sunday morning early to pack the car so it would be ready to rush back to Wichita after church, he was out there cleaning my windshield with Windex and paper towels. We had an absolutely marvelous time there, but that particular image will stick in my mind, I suppose, because it was so simple, so common, so ordinary, so quietly and beautifully helpful. I was reading one of Robin's sermons. We read one another's sermons and pick at them. And I came upon this paragraph, which I am about to read. He spoke of his mother and how good it was to come home from school at noon for a hug and a hot meal, and how she was the one who saw to it that the clothes were clean and not hopelessly out of fashion. All the gifts he took for granted, but which shaped his notion of what it means to love. I hoped I'd squeak in there somewhere, but I would never have guessed, could never have remembered, what odd little thing he would use to illustrate my love and how he remembered it on one occasion. Here's the paragraph. I remember some of my father's greatest sermons well, but not so well as I remember him one Christmas morning, sitting cross-legged on the floor for hours, trying to help me put together a plastic conglomeration with 1,000 pieces called a visible engine, because I knew it was hard for him, not something he was good at. Oh, you told the truth, Robin. But something he put himself through to be helpful and to spend time with me. Saint Teresa used to spend a lot of time in the kitchen. And when someone asked whether she considered that holy, she said, "The Lord walks among the pots and pans just as much as in the Garden of Eden." The kitchen, she knew, and I believe, is part of the garden. Every nook and cranny of this world is the garden. And everywhere in it, there is need for celestial intimacy to go hand in hand with domestic manners. If you walk with God, you must walk sometimes with a cripple. If you talk with God, you must talk sometimes with someone who is lonely and frightened, even if you are very busy. And do it soon, because time gets away. When I was young, a certain poem says, I aimed at laurels. I would be president. I'd be public hero number one. I'd personally win the World Series in the last half of the ninth. And later on, I dreamed of being Pulitzered, Guggenheimed, Nobeled, for being a wizard of the word. But soon the due date will arrive, and I shall have to cash in all my hopes and dreams. There is no longer time for blowing bubbles in the air, and I must carefully cultivate this little plot of land that's left. Once in a while, somebody says, "What's your philosophy of life? What is it?" When you strip it down to the bare essentials, and if I can remember to say it, I say something like that. I want carefully to cultivate the little plot of land that is mine. And to love what the poem says is to be loved. The simple things that are left when most other things are gone. The wind on the cheek. The trees when they are bare and when they are in leaf. The upcoming and downgoing of the sun. The flight of wild geese across an early evening moon, a quiet talk with a troubled friend, the happiness of helping someone. Or, if you wanted to put it another way, I want to be at the party in Cana of Galilee with the man who was glad to be there and who laughed and hugged and enjoyed life with all his might. I want my sermons to say, always, this simple thing to you. Come to the party.